Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Giving all praise and honor to God.
On a sweltering summer day in June 2015, then-President Barack Obama stood before a crowded arena in Charleston, South Carolina.
The Bible calls us to hope, to persevere, and have faith in things not seen.
He was there to give the eulogy for the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, a state senator and the senior pastor of the historic Mother Emanuel AME Church.
He embodied the idea that our Christian faith demands deeds and not just words. That to put our faith in action is more than just individual salvation, it's about our collective salvation. That to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and house the homeless is not just a call for isolated charity, but the imperative of a just society.
Down along the front row, just yards from where Obama stood, eulogizing Pinckney, the Reverend's widow sat draped in all black, with a lacy hat framing her head like a beautiful, sad rose. Their two little girls wore white bows in their hair. The president called their father a good man and a good model of faith.
And then to lose him at 41, slain in his sanctuary with eight wonderful members of his flock, but bound together by a common commitment to God. Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, DePayne Middleton Doctor, Iwanza Sanders, Daniel L. Simmons, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Myra Thompson. Good people. God-fearing people. To the families of the fallen, the nation shares in your grief.
I was there that day, and from a dozen yards away, as songs of Sweet Jesus and Sweet Redemption unfurled high into the rafters, I watched the younger of the Pinckney girls take tiny, measured steps toward her father's casket, saying goodbye the way no little girl ever should. It had been just 9 days since a white supremacist walked into Wednesday night Bible study held in the basement of Mother Emanuel Church and prayed with a group of parishioners before he opened fire on them, killing 9 people, including Reverend Pinckney. The attack shook the congregation and America to its core, and it became part of history.
Well, what your faith says is that you should forgive others for what they've done, is that it's not for you to judge, but it's for someone else to judge. And so they...
I'm back in the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, touring an exhibit called Make Good the Promises on the Legacy of Reconstruction with Emeritus Director Spencer Crew.
You know, throughout this exhibit, there have been so many moments that have given us hope, right, in the history and the context. Yeah. That make us feel good about who we are, right, and pushing forward. But there are items like this from Mother Emanuel Church, a Bible that was there that day, and a letter that's kind of heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking because it says that you cannot even practice your faith in safety.
Toward the end of the exhibit, there's a display case dedicated to the Mother Emanuel Church shooting.
That is what breaks everyone's heart, is that they are doing nothing that would warrant this kind of attack, but they're under attack because they are at this church and because they're African American. And it makes us all sort of, I think, worry about the world in which you can find yourself under attack for no other reason than you are who you are.
Spencer is showing me a Bible that belongs to Polly Shepherd, one of five survivors of the shooting, along with some Bible study notes from that night. The notes are on Mark chapter 4, the parable of the sower, typed up and printed on plain white paper.
And as a kid, I went to Bible study many, many times, and I see the familiar. It's highlighted. She has this long passage highlighted.
Exactly.
And one of those pages
folded over.
Yeah. It seems so familiar.
Yeah, just as you would expect a Bible leader to do. And right next to it are some of the notes that the Bible leader that day had put together to lead that class. So again, what it does is I think it makes it human. It makes it much more real and much more visceral. And if we just talked about it abstractly, I think that's the power of what these kind of objects can do in an exhibition.
Reconstruction ended a century and a half ago, but these objects from 2015 are here in the Smithsonian because in so many ways, the legacy of the Reconstruction era continues to guide us today. The Mother Emanuel attack may have been a single night of violence, but it began lifetimes ago.
Time and again in talking to people, they talk about this resilience of this community, that they are a faithful community, but they are a resilient and strong community. But when you talk about the greater context of what South Carolina meant to the slave trade.
Back in 2015, I was in Charleston reporting on the massacre for NBC News. And I remember it clear as day. This guy came over to me and said, "I want to show you something." He took me to what's called the Hanging Tree, where people were once lynched, not too far from the church. And he took me to the Citadel, which is now a prestigious military college, but originally it was formed as a slave patrol. There's a covered market nearby, still in operation, where white folks with enough money once bought and sold other human beings. As beautiful as this city is, with its cobblestone streets and angel oak trees and horse-drawn carriages, its soil is soaked in blood. Generations of enslaved people toiled in this city to death. The Mother Emanuel massacre was just one incarnation of the violence heaped upon black bodies here. Yet somehow, Black Charleston has always pushed through it all. Despite the weight of the violence and bloodshed, they have continued to make a way. Resilience is as much a tradition in this city as violence. After the Civil War ended and Reconstruction began, the formerly enslaved were able to buy land, establish formal communities, and organize politically. And the Black church served as a conduit for this nascent freedom building. Even before emancipation, Black folks were building faith communities and networks of churches, using the scripture to circumvent the strictures of white society. But there would always be backlash. Throughout time and across geography, in the South in particular, white violence has often been aimed squarely at the Black church and its members, because the church represented Black power, freedom, and faith. More than just places to worship, the church has been a refuge, a place to organize, to educate, and to uplift. Faith was a guiding principle, but also something very practical. It was armor and an arsenal when the spurs of white supremacy cut deep. And I want to be clear, this faith is about more than religiosity. I'm talking about faith as fortitude, faith as strength, a kind of faith that no Christian, Muslim, or Jew has sold dominion over. This sort of faith has buoyed us throughout our history. Faith is what helped deliver us from the evil of slavery, guiding people like Harriet Tubman along the Underground Railroad, sending them toward freedom in the dark of night, using spirituals and secret codes.
Coming for to carry me. I look toward the ordinance.
Faith was at the center of the civil rights movements, helping us to organize and plot and face the world together, as we're reminded in this sermon from Pastor and Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr.
Keep the faith, baby. As I walk the streets of the Harlems of the world, people are depressed. They are frustrated. They are downtrodden. They see no hope. They see no tomorrows. And I say to them always, keep the faith, baby.
And it's a sort of secular faith, a hope for the future, that pushes so many people onto the streets when it's time to fight and protest injustice today.
No justice, no peace. Prosecute the police.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Black lives matter. Black lives matter. Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Black lives matter. Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
Black lives matter.
I'm Trymaine Lee, and this is Into America. For generations, the church is where we've educated our children and exercised political agency. It's where, over and again, we've harnessed the faith to keep moving forward, despite opposition and violence. There are few better examples of this than the historic African Methodist Episcopal Church, and Mother Emmanuel AME in particular. So today, we're looking at Mother Emmanuel to understand faith as a source of power, pride, and rebellion. This is Reconstructed Part 3. Keep the faith, baby.
Keep the faith, baby.
Keep the faith!
Because God's realities always exceed man's fondest dreams.
The church is and always has been the center of African American life. A place to call our own in a too often hostile world. A sanctuary from so many hardships.
When President Obama delivered the eulogy for Reverend Pinckney, he was sending a message intended to ring out far beyond the audience.
That's what the Black church means. The place where our dignity as a people is inviolate. And there's no better example of this tradition than Mother Emmanuel. A church church built by Blacks seeking liberty, burned to the ground because its founders sought to end slavery, only to rise up again, a phoenix from these ashes.
As a member of Emmanuel, I think that courage is not the strength to go on, but going on when you have no strength. When you don't stand up for something, you'll fall for anything. So I'm just here to let you know that I stand for something.
Elizabeth Austin has been a member of Mother Emmanuel for more than 50 years. She was in the audience for Reverend Clementa Pinckney's eulogy. She remembers the pain and devastation of those early days after the tragedy, but also the strength of the congregation.
The connectiveness, spirituality is there. The love is there. The compassion is there. I can thank Mother Emmanuel for me being faith-based. Whenever something comes up, that your religion takes hold. And Emmanuel has been that for most of us.
So Mother Emmanuel is a place of compassion, of faith. But as Obama said that day, it's also been a place of resistance. Mother Emmanuel isn't the church's original name. Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church was the first AME church in the South and quickly gained such reverence that people began lovingly using the term Mother.
Where you are is a very special place in Charleston.
This is from an old video of Reverend Pinckney, 2 years before the shooting. It's from a talk given to a group of doctoral students from Northeastern University. The tape is courtesy of the Mulliken Law Firm. In it, the Reverend talks about the history of Mother Emanuel and the AME denomination, which dates back to the late 18th century in Philadelphia. It's important for you to hear this history from Reverend Pinckney in his own words.
We started in 1787 through our founder, Richard Allen, who left then St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church because they were telling him he needed to pray after the regular members prayed. And so that's how the denomination began, in a fit of civil disobedience and a little issue with theological fairness, if you will. What our church and denomination stands for is really, it stands for the universal vision of all people being treated fairly under the law as God sees us in his sight.
Mother Emanuel was founded in 1818 by Morris Brown, a free, prosperous black man, after he paid a visit to the original AME church in Philly. And like that first AME, Brown's church also became a center of resistance to the white power structure.
In about 1822, there was an interesting minister here whose name was Denmark Vesey. And Denmark Vesey planned an insurrection.
Denmark Vesey believed slavery was contrary to the laws of God and that those in bondage were bound by God to free themselves. With a few dozen men, he planned to seize weapons, set Charleston on fire, and kill the mayor and any other white men who tried to stop them. Then he planned to set sail to Haiti, which had won its independence about two decades earlier.
The rebellion was planned so well that once the authorities found out about it, they had a little Guantanamo experiment. They basically took Denmark Vesey and all of the co-conspirators that they could find, and they interrogated them.
The white authorities tortured Vesey and his comrades. 150 people were arrested, and Vesey and 34 other men were hanged. Mother Emanuel was burned to the ground. But the state didn't stop there. Reverend Pinckney tells it like this.
The state of South Carolina really, really got concerned and scared. And so we have the military college of South Carolina, the Citadel. Does anyone know where the original site of the Citadel was? You actually passed it on Meeting Street. The guns of the Citadel were basically facing this site and the community of Africans, African Americans, who were living in this area. And that's how the Citadel got started.
9 years after Vesey's failed revolt, and 350 miles to the north, there was another rebellion in the works, also rooted in faith. On August 21st, 1831, Nat Turner, an enslaved black preacher, led a revolt in Virginia. Turner and dozens of other men, some on horseback, went house to house, freeing black people and killing more than 50 white residents along the way. But the victory was short-lived. At least 200 black people, including Nat Turner, were eventually captured and killed. In the aftermath, states across the South passed laws banning black people from reading and writing, hoping it would prevent another Nat Turner. And 3 years later, in 1834, South Carolina cracked down on the places where these rebellions had taken shape. Here's the late Reverend Pinckney once again.
The state of South Carolina, because of the work of black congregations in Charleston, to include Emanuel, teaching persons to read, and really, in a sense, sort of fomenting this desire that all people should be free in the state, basically put out a law or instituted a law that closed Emanuel. I mean, by state law, the church was closed along with others.
The congregation of Mother Emanuel and so many others went underground, hiding from white authorities, but the flame of faith and resistance was never extinguished. Then, after the Civil War, 4 million black people were finally free. And with that freedom came the right to worship the way they chose. Back at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, curator Spencer Crew explains it like this.
Religion had always been an important part in the African American community, but often the churches they went to under enslavement were churches that were run by the landowners. And at those churches, the key thing was to remind you to be a good servant, to do as you are directed, and then you'll get your reward later on. But as they gained their freedom with the end of the Civil War and into Reconstruction, you see many more African-American churches emerging, churches in which they can control what goes on in them. And this is critical.
During Reconstruction, free Black Americans were founding towns all across the South, and often in towns like Promised Land, where we visited last week. One of the first communal buildings to go up was a church.
Because what the church is an institution that is supported by the African American community.
Faith and the church had been a well of quiet resistance before the war, in revolts like Nat Turner's, or the rebellious act of running away, or in simply surviving enslavement. And after the war, these new black churches carried on the tradition, out loud and in the open. Spencer says that many of the black political leaders during Reconstruction got their start in the church. In fact, Richard Harvey Kane, one of Mother Emanuel's first preachers during Reconstruction, would go on to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Churches become an important place where people can practice leadership, where they can speak up and debate and share their ideas and learn how to convince others about their point of view, and now are able to take that skill and to go out into the larger community.
But with power comes attention and jealousy. And for the newly freed, this often meant being the target of white violence and terror.
What we have located here are some of the ways in which they sought to create this sense of terror.
Spencer takes me to the part of the Reconstruction exhibit that's full of artifacts tied to this white violence.
We have what is a very interesting Ku Klux Klan hat. It doesn't look like the ones you normally would see, in the sense that you think about the white hood by itself. That's more of a 20th century. In the early days, people would create their own kind of different hoods and hats to wear. The idea is that they were trying to intimidate and frighten the people they went to see, so they'd make them as ghoulish and as scary as they could.
I gotta say, to call this thing a hat doesn't begin to capture what it looks like. It's more like a mask made from old yellowed bedsheets. There are three long stuffed fabric horns jutting from the skull, and a long pointy red cone for a nose, and bushy black eyebrows over the outline of dead eyes. And sticking out of the mouth are three long fangs. It's somewhere between goofy and grotesque.
It's from North Carolina, and it really illustrates the kind of different ways in which people would dress up to try to intimidate African Americans and others who would be helping them.
But they also commit acts of violence in these masks?
Oh, absolutely. If the intimidation doesn't work by itself, then violence becomes the next step.
Sometimes a church itself would be the target, but perhaps more often, these white terrorists attacked the people connected to the church.
Harriet Postol is from York County, South Carolina. She was married to a preacher named Isaac.
This is Kadada Williams. She's a history professor at Wayne State University and has written a book about racist violence aimed at African Americans. Much of her book is based on testimonies from victims. What she's about to read is testimony from a preacher's wife, Harriet Postol. It was recorded during a federal investigation into the KKK in 1871. Quick warning, the passage contains graphic violence and strong language.
She describes when KKK members, her neighbors, visited her in her home, asking her for her husband, who had snuck out of the house just before they arrived. The group of white men then began beating her in front of her children. She said, "The one who had his foot on my body mashed me badly, for not so badly as he might have done, for I was 7 or 8 months gone travail. Then I got outside the house and sat down, and I called the little ones to me, for they were all dreadfully frightened. They said my husband was there, and they would shoot in every crack to get him. And they did shoot all over the place. There are bullet holes there and bullet marks on the hearth yet. And they say to me, "We're going to have the truth out of you, you damn lying bitch. He is somewhere about here." Said I, "He is gone." And with that, he beat my head against the side of the house till I had not since barely left, but I still had hold of my babe.
And there's another one from South Carolina. This one from a preacher named Elias Hill, who'd also been involved in local politics for liberal candidates. As part of that same investigation, he told federal officials about the night 6 members of the KKK dragged him out of his bed and into the yard.
They pointed pistols at me all around my head once or twice, as if they were going to shoot me, telling me they were going to kill me. Wasn't I ready to die and willing to die? Did I preach? One caught me by the leg and hurt me. He had a horsewhip, and he told me to pull up my shirt, and he hit me. I reckon he struck me 8 cuts, right on the hip bone. They said I must quit preaching and put a notice in the newspaper renouncing Republicanism. But if I did not, they would come back the next week and kill me.
Eventually, the men let Mr. Hill's sister bring him back to bed, but they followed him into the room.
They said, "Don't pray against the Ku Klux, but pray that God may forgive Ku Klux. Pray that God may bless and save us." I was so chilled with cold, lying out of doors for so long, and in such pain, that I could not speak to pray, but I tried to. And they said that would do very well.
These organized white attacks happened all over the South for decades, impacting countless black families. Many fought back, fending off these terrorists with guns of their own. But Kidada says the trauma was deep and long-lasting.
I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that most people who experience this violence aren't going to be able to John Henry their way through this. They're not going to be able to power on. A lot of them are completely devastated by what happened to them. Their loved ones are killed before their eyes. They are left with disabling injuries. Some people experience things like paralytic fright, where they freeze, and that makes them vulnerable to being carried away. And sometimes it can devastate a parent to not be able to protect their child in the context of this violence. And all of those leave long-term scars on the people who live through these attacks.
Hmm. How did Black folks try to fortify themselves, ourselves, against this stuff? There were institutions being built in our communities, but how did we move forward in the idea of faith?
Well, some people move forward, some people don't. But I think a lot of them, there is this sort of understanding that they had lived through slavery and they had lived through the war, and they had survived these attacks that were intended to kill them. And so for a lot of them, there was the commitment and the belief and the need to move forward, because they had a world to build for their children. Yeah. They had a future to make for themselves and for the people they held dear. So they have a sense of faith. That faith allowed them to live through slavery and survive the war. And those are no small things. They're quite significant. Mm. And that faith is also what brings a lot of those people forward into the world after it's been turned upside down by this violence.
It's this faith in ourselves that has sustained Black people through our darkest times. The faith that we can push America to a place where our whole selves are finally free.
And that's what church is all about.
This is Reverend Clementa Pinckney again from his 2013 talk to students.
And sometimes you got to make noise to do that. Sometimes you may have to die like Denmark Vesey to do that. Sometimes you have to march and struggle and be unpopular to do that.
There's a line in the Bible that Black Americans have long known to be true. It's from James chapter 2, verse 26. It goes, "Faith without works is dead." Back in the Smithsonian, Spencer Crew says this principle is at the heart of the Black church.
It illustrates the kind of power of community church can have and how to use that as a stepping stone for other kind of activism, and that freedom should come immediately. Freedom is something you have to take and move forward with yourself and not wait for others to make it happen for you. And look at the modern civil rights movement and all the leadership that's there. A lot of them are ministers.
The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s was born in churches and buoyed by faith. Its preacher leaders followed in the footsteps of Harriet Tubman and Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner. But this time, they pushed for fair treatment within the system rather than overthrowing or escaping it. And they were able to mobilize people on a scale that this country had never seen.
You can turn your back on me, but you cannot turn your back upon the idea of justice.
You must find a way to get in the way. You must find a way to get in trouble, the trouble, necessary trouble.
We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation, all of them from the same enemy.
How do we get our kids back in the struggle and in the movement? Well, you see, it's right down in the trenches where they are.
And when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington in August 1963, his message of resistance in faith rang out far beyond the church, reaching millions.
With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day.
But like so many times before, the push for freedom was met with violence. Just 1 month after the March on Washington, white supremacists bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Alabama, murdering four little girls. The 60s also witnessed the assassination of Malcolm X, who always led with a fiery brand of faith.
Instead of the so-called Negro man continuing to watch his churches being bombed and his little girls being murdered, it's time for the so-called Negro man to take a stand.
And when Dr. King was gunned down, as he fought against poverty and injustice, that faith was tested again. Then in 2015, when that young white supremacist murdered nine people at Mother Emanuel during Bible study, no less, the nation once again was reminded that our bloody racist history isn't history at all.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and eight others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress.
But resistance, through faith, doesn't live in the past either.
You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God.
Coming up, in the aftermath of the shooting at Mother Emanuel Church, how one woman felt called to undertake a daring act of bravery in the name of faith and freedom.
And
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
For too long, we were blind to the pain that the Confederate flag stirred in too many of our citizens. It's true, a flag did not cause these murders. But as we all have to acknowledge, the flag has always represented more than just ancestral pride.
Two days before President Obama delivered this sermon, the body of Reverend Clementa Pinckney, the man he was eulogizing, lay in state in the rotunda of South Carolina's Capitol building in Columbia. Just steps away on the Capitol lawn flew the Confederate battle flag, the flag that his killer proudly posed for pictures with before the shooting.
For many, black and white, that flag was a reminder of systemic oppression and racial subjugation. We see that now. Removing the flag from this state's capital.
As Obama was saying these words, a group of activists had already hatched a plan.
My name is Bree Newsom Bass. I claim the whole Carolinas because that's where my people are from, but I am in Raleigh, North Carolina right now.
Bree Newsom Bass is an artist and activist. As the daughter of a Baptist preacher, she grew up learning that faith and freedom were deeply intertwined.
On both sides of my family, I had ancestors who were enslaved and then founded churches on the plantations where they were. Wow. And then built brick and mortar churches after slavery. So my understanding of Christianity was very much tied to the history of Black people, right? And this idea that if God brought the Hebrews out of Egypt, he would bring us out of bondage, you know, that kind of narrative, the belief in a God who cares very much about the poor and the oppressed.
But it wasn't until she was in her 20s that she found her own path of activism through faith.
The turning point for me, like a lot of people, was like 2012, 2013, the Trayvon Martin case, the attacks on voting rights. That was the moment where I made a more conscious decision. Like, I'm going to devote a significant part of my energy and my time and my life and my efforts to this cause.
Then the Mother Emanuel shooting.
I remember calling my sister, because my sister had heard the news and we were just crying. And, you know, I'm just asking, like, how long does this go on? That attack on the church, it felt very much like the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church. You know, that's a conversation I'm having with God. Like, how long does this go on? Why is this even happening?
Dylann Roof would eventually be convicted of multiple murder and hate crime charges and sentenced to death. But Bree remembers how in those early days, people refused to call what he did, those heinous acts, terrorism.
And then, of course, the focus went to the Confederate flag.
The flag had been a source of contention for decades. In 2000, Reverend Pinckney himself argued to remove the flag from the floor of the South Carolina Senate.
As a pastor of a church, I listen to the stories and the pains of the people who feel so offended by the fact that a flag that has been used as a symbol to brutalize, demoralize, and humiliate them still flies in our state capitol. I hear those stories.
But after the shooting, debate hit a fever pitch.
It's a symbol to those men who fought and died on the war.
It should be taken down.
My heritage, my right
to keep this flying on our Capitol ground.
Take the flag down!
We want this for all of our people, all of our children, to get this hatred out of our society and our minds.
For society to allow the focus of the aftermath of the Charleston massacre to be the flag, that is very clearly saying that the flag matters more than the lives that were lost, you know? Mm. We're not talking about humanity, we're talking about a piece of nylon fabric. And we're doing that because of the symbol. We're doing that because it's a symbol of white power.
Bree knew that she had to do something.
I moved to action. You know, that's where I go, because I do strongly believe that faith without works is dead. And I don't think that we are called to simply be passive observers to evil in the world. We are called to be active participants in the fight for justice. And so for me, it was, what can I do? Apparently Rosa Parks, after the lynching of Emmett Till, she said, you know, you killed Emmett Till, I'm going to take down your whole system. Like, oof. Mm. Like, I felt that. Like, I felt, because I think that is my feeling too.
Bree was in Charlotte, North Carolina, about an hour and a half north of Columbia. She started talking to other activists about what they could do. And what they kept coming back to was the flag.
Once the power structure demonstrates that, like, the flag is what they care about, you know, then the flag is what has to come down.
They thought up different ways of handling the situation.
Do we shoot an arrow with fire at it? I mean, we thought about taking it down and replacing it with another flag.
But in the end, they decided the best way to get their message across was to simply take the flag down.
Because if all I do is go up and take it down, they can't talk about anything else except whether they're going to leave the flag down or raise it back up. You can't talk about, oh, look at these vandals who set it on fire. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about, oh, what is this flag that they replaced it with? You can't talk about anything.
But in order to get the flag down, they would need to get up to it first. And that meant that someone would have to scale a 30-foot flagpole in full view of the Capitol and the police and anyone else who might want the flag to stay right where it was.
There was a basic question we had to ask. There was about 9 of us who were gathered there. And the question was, who could do it, who could train on how to do it, and who could risk being arrested?
Bree had no climbing experience, but she volunteered anyway, because what she did have was something more powerful.
What added another layer to it was my personal history. You know, my ancestors were in South Carolina. Like, I'm directly descended from people. I can go to the grounds where my ancestors were enslaved, because my family never moved far from where we had been. So that history was very personal to me. And so with me being the one to do it, I could carry all of that with me.
From that moment, Bree had just 4 days to learn how to climb.
I faced waves of fear, like in those 4 days between when I, you know, volunteered to do it. In fact, I remember the very first time I attempted climbing, I was like, I don't think I can do this.
With help from experienced climbers, she kept practicing. But even as the climbing got easier, Bree and the other activists had a lot to consider.
We had to decide beforehand, if somebody shows up with a gun, what do we do? And we decided that everybody runs for cover. I made peace with the fact that I might die. But it is an act of love. It is an act of love in the way that Jesus demonstrated.
On Friday, June 26, 2015, Bree and other activists made the drive to Columbia. On the way down, they listened to President Obama's eulogy, and Bree meditated on what she was about to do.
For many, black and white, that flag was a reminder of systemic oppression and racial subjugation.
After just a few hours of sleep, Bree and the other activists met at an IHOP by the Capitol. They climbed into cars and headed to the State House. Arriving before the sun, the team began to take their positions.
We had people who, for instance, were just pretending to be out and about jogging or, you know, doing whatever in the park, and they were like the lookout.
Bree and James Tyson, a white activist from the Charlotte area, were the ones whose job it was to actually remove the flag.
And so we were waiting in the car. I had practiced all of it. I pulled my gear on in the car, inside the car, because, you know, you don't want somebody to look over and see you pulling this gear on in the parking lot.
In addition to her climbing harness and helmet, Bree decided to wear all black that day as tribute to the Black Power movement. Then it was time. Bree and James walked slowly and deliberately toward the flagpole.
We practiced walking very, you know, resolutely, but don't run, because running would draw attention. And we had James wear a safety vest and a white construction helmet. So if anybody were to glance over, you know, it just looks like we are maybe doing some construction work or something down there. And we walked over. James held his hand down so I could step into his hands, and he helped me over the fence. I did end up falling on the fence some kind of way because one of the spokes went through my hand, but I was filled with so much adrenaline at that point that I just kept going.
The goal was for Bree to get at least 8 feet up the flagpole before any officials took notice.
We felt like if I could at least get to that point, nobody could easily reach up and grab me. And then I can pause and catch my breath if I need to. I don't think I was too far up before the police were over there and shouting at me to come down.
Ma'am, ma'am, get off the pole. Ma'am, ma'am, come down off the pole. Ma'am, come down off the pole.
Ma'am. I had planned to climb in silence. I wasn't really planning to like make any statements or anything like while I was doing it. But the police yelling at me is what prompted me to like talk back to them. And, you know, I'm saying this is a nonviolent action. And I can't remember. Somebody said something like, this doesn't have anything to do with you. And I was like, my ancestors were enslaved here. This has everything to do with, like, please don't tell me this doesn't have anything to do with me.
And then in this moment, with her adrenaline pumping, Bree Newsom began to pray.
I prayed the 27th Psalm. I said, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?
The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?
And that was like reminding myself, you know, like, okay, Lord, you know, like, okay. I will go where you tell me to go. Just be with me. Just be with me.
At the top of the flagpole, Bree unhooked the Confederate flag and yelled,
"You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today."
Scaling the pole, being at the top, holding the flag in my hand, like looking down and out across the city, I actually had a tremendous sense of peace. Like, wow. I've never felt anything like that before or since. I believe it was the Holy Spirit. I believe that I had an experience of the Holy Spirit because I truly did believe that I was called in that moment to take that flag down.
So you climb 30 feet high, you know, you have that flag in your hand, the police are there. Walk us through like coming down the pole and everything that happened next.
It was right when I was getting ready to take it down that they threatened to tase me. So there was this point where they had like three or four people with tasers trained on me. I'm attached to a metal pole, and they're talking about they're going to electrocute me pretty much, right?
I'm trying to come down, sir. I'm going to comply. I promise you. I'm coming down. I'm prepared to be arrested.
Once I was able to actually unhook the flag, I mean, that felt like victory from there. I was kind of like, I'm ready to be arrested now, you know, because we've done it. Whatever happens from here happens.
But on the ground below, those cops still had their tasers pointed her way.
And so that's why if you see the video when I'm coming down, James is holding onto the pole because he's basically saying, like, if you do that, you're going to have to electrocute me too. And people are standing around and shouting. And so as I'm coming down, after they have just threatened to electrocute me, their big thing was that the flag not touch the ground.
Wow.
At one point, we had to tell them, like, let the flag go because she can't come down. Like, the way you're pulling on the flag, she can't even come down. And it was like their whole thing was just like, this flag cannot.
That's crazy.
Cannot touch the ground. We're not even treating human life with that kind of reverence.
With Bree's feet planted firmly on the ground, James untethered her from the pole, and people around her erupted.
And of course, they arrested us. And as they were leading us away, that's when I started praying the 23rd Psalm. You know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.
He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside still waters.
What in the word of God? What are they arresting him for?
Almost immediately, Bree knew she'd done something important. As she was being arrested, one of the officers, a black man, paused.
As we were being taken down into, like, they had, like, a holding area there at the Capitol, and that's when one of the officers asked me, like, why did you do that? Like I could tell, like, even in him, it was like there was this part of him that was the officer. Like, he has on the uniform. He has his job is, like, guard the flag and do what he has to do. But even in that moment, I think I felt like something was shifting for him, too, because he was kind of like, what did I just experience? Like, what did I just see? In the tone of his voice, it was like he was thinking about it in a different way for the first time, maybe.
Wow.
It wasn't like, why did you do that? Right. You know, it wasn't like that. It was like,
Bree and James were charged with defacing monuments on state capitol grounds. The charges were later dropped, and Bree became an icon of the movement. But more importantly, her action worked.
Today, in the shadow of the South Carolina State House, it took an honor guard just 36 seconds to lower a symbol that has divided this nation for a century and a half. The applause was thunderous and sustained.
Less than 2 weeks after Bree climbed that pole, removing this symbol of hatred, the change was made permanent. On July 9th, 2015, then-Governor Nikki Haley signed a bipartisan bill to remove the flag from statehouse grounds. The next day, the flag was lowered for the very last time and sent a mile away to the Confederate Relic Room, the state's military museum.
I am not convinced that they ever would have taken it down had we not done what we did.
Bree's climbing gear from that day now sits on display at the Smithsonian's Exhibit on Reconstruction. You see her black pants and t-shirt and the helmet she wore. And there's an ordinary navy blue JanSport backpack with climbing carabiners clipped onto a series of cords where a pair of scissors, a wrench, and a pair of pliers all hang. Practical, ordinary tools that helped her do something extraordinary.
I was just tremendously honored. I mean, it's so interesting how things become historic artifacts because those were, I mean, prior to them being historic artifacts, these were just things I had in my closet that I'm pulling out and trying to decide what am I going to wear as I do this action.
With her climbing gear in the museum, Bree's place in history is cemented. But Bree's not just concerned about what was or has been. She's guided by the faith of what could be.
I think that, you know, it is as much about the present as it is about the past. In fact, it's more about the present. Because the question is, what are we building now? You know, I also view the flag removal as a form of Afrofuturism. It's about imagining a Black future that has yet to exist. We have to talk about the past because the past is what informs our understanding of today. But I really want to talk about the future. I want to talk about what we are imagining in the aftermath. And that to me is the power of that image as well, of the flag coming down, because it symbolizes the toppling of these things. Like, it was here and now it's gone.
I ask Bree how she sees herself fitting into this long history of Black faith and freedom fighting.
I absolutely place myself in that tradition where our resistance is not just political. It is spiritual. It is about the Black prophetic tradition. Because the belief that we will be delivered from white supremacy is a prophecy. That's not something that has happened yet. That's a prophecy. So we're operating in this prophetic belief that Harriet Tubman was truly a prophet, right? And that she was guided by the Holy Spirit when she's leading people to freedom. I mean, I identify that as the tradition that I came out of. I grew up with them telling me about my great-great-great-grandmother and how she would pray to God that we would see freedom, and now her children have seen freedom. So it's very much this sense of people being led by faith.
A lot has changed for Bree since that day in 2015 when she climbed that flagpole and snatched down the Confederate flag. She got married and became a mother, but she's still an activist. And it's that moment, 30 feet off the ground, racist battle emblem in hand, that gives her the strength to keep pushing today.
I had an experience of the divine. Mm. And it was love and peace and selflessness. And I can only hope that at the end of my life, that is what I get returned to.
This whole week, I've been reflecting on this idea of grace. What a friend of mine, the writer Marilynne Robinson, calls that reservoir of goodness. If we can find that grace, anything is possible. If we can tap that grace, everything can change. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saves. Found that grace. Cynthia Hurd found that grace. Susie Jackson found that grace. Ethel Lance found that grace. The Payne Middleton doctor found that grace. Tywanza Sanders found that grace. Daniel Yell Simmons Sr. found that grace. Sharonda Coleman Singleton found that grace.
As Bree Newsom continues to live her life, fueled by faith and activism, justice, and grace. She thinks about the sacrifices that so many Black people have made along the way, willingly or not. Bree told us earlier, her work, like so many activists, has been fueled in large part by the death of Trayvon Martin, the 17-year-old boy shot and killed by vigilante in Sanford, Florida, 10 years ago. Over the past decade, the legacy of Trayvon's death has left us and this country forever changed. The tragedy of his senseless killing and all of the injustice baked into it is one of the more visceral legacies of Reconstruction.
What Trayvon Martin's experience and his death illustrates is that there are only certain places where people of color should be that are acceptable, continues to be an important part of how our lives are defined today.
More than just anguish and loss, Trayvon's killing signaled a new era in the movement toward truer freedom in America. An era when a generation rose and proclaimed loudly, unapologetically, that Black lives matter. Next week, in the fourth and final installment of our Reconstructed series, we bring you The Book of Trayvon. Remember to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook using the handle @IntoAmericaPod. That's @IntoAmericaPod. And you can tweet me @TremaineLee or write to us at IntoAmerica@NBCUNI.com. That was IntoAmerica@NBC and the letters UNI.com.
Keep the faith, baby.
Into America is produced by Isabel Angel, Allison Bailey, Aaron Dalton, Max Jacobs, and Joshua Sirodiak. Original music is by Hannes Brown. Our executive producer is Aisha Turner. Special thanks this week to Stephanie Cargill, along with Tom Cracker, Jim Long, Tom Statton, and Andy Scritchfield. Shout out to Floor Pesor, Melissa Wood, and the entire team at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And thank you to the Mulliken Law Firm in Camden, South Carolina, for giving their permission to use their recording of Reverend Pinckney. I'm Tremaine Lee. We'll see you next Thursday for Reconstructed Part 4, The Book of Trayvon.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.